Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters. I'm Jamil Zainashev, and you're listening to Brew Strong on thebrewingnetwork.com. I'm here today with my good friend, travel companion, award-winning brewer, Travis Comble. How's it going, brother?
Doing fine. Thank you, Jamil. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Ready for another beer. What are you drinking tonight?
I'm drinking Enjoy By, which I think... Have they changed hands? Has Stone changed hands or something? Because some of the beers they have on your favorite app, Untappd, say the Arrogant Consortia. I thought that was like me and my buddies, but, you know, I don't know.
You guys are arrogant somethings.
You know it. Yeah, bastards is an understatement.
Yeah, I don't know. Wasn't there some sort of news, something they got some investment or something? I don't know.
Maybe so. I don't know. I guess I got busy.
I can't keep track of all that.
Same.
What I am having is a collab with Elusive Brewing in England. We went and made a Janus Brown there. And this is, I think, I don't want to get this wrong, because I'm pretty sure Mitch shipped me when we did the collab at Stone, the Unapologetic. He shipped me beer. And I don't want to offend anybody else that may have shipped me beer, but I think most of the time when I've done collabs with people, they don't bother to get me any of the beer. I mean, if it's down the street, they don't bring me any beer. They don't ship it to me. It's like you can show up in a tap room and buy a pint. All right. Well, this Andy at Elusive, people talking about him as the nicest person in brewing. And I tell you, he really is. He had a buddy of his mule it out to California so I could have some. Now, how about that?
Is that what you've been drinking all evening?
No.
Okay, because your glass has been dark.
This is the first time I've had it, actually.
Oh, wow. It's a nice head.
Oh, wow. Nice.
You said that was made in England?
Yes.
So English ale yeast, or do they use years old Chico or something?
I forget what yeast we use, but he will absolutely tell you.
Makes me want to brew a Janus with an English ale yeast.
But we used some modern hop products in it. Uh-huh. And so it's got a different kind of hoppy. So Janus Brown goes back to the Cascade and Columbus and Centennial type of hops. It's hops. It's fairly brown and bitter and all that. And this is a more modern take on the hops. Yeah, it's really nice. They brew some great beer at Elusive. If you're ever out there, you need to get you some Elusive.
Do you remember what the hop products were that you used?
I'm challenging my
and by hop products, I'm assuming you mean and I'm kind of asking because Patrick's in the chat talking about hop ash, et cetera, which is, and we've had hop ash for quite a while. And I still do use Idaho 7 hop ash in one of my beers. I like what it does. But there's so many products these days. You did a show recently with Scott Janish on that, right?
Let's see here. I'm pulling up the... God bless him. He even did a 20-liter version. So if you're in the UK, you can actually get this recipe kit for the malt miller. Let's see. So used a Simpsons, a low color Simpsons. We used some dextrin malt, light crystal, Simpsons light crystal, Simpsons malted wheat, Simpsons chocolate malt. The hops were Cascade, Northern Brewer, Cascade add during the mash, Northern Brewer during the boil, 60 minutes. Northern Brewer boiled 15 minutes, Cascade during the boil, 10 minutes, and Cascade at the end of the boil, some hop unlock, and some Centennial Lupomax in the dry hop.
I know Lupomax, but unlock I'm not familiar with. And you mash hop.
Yes, that was something Tasty liked to do. I mean, I could rattle off the whole recipe if you think it's useful. Or you check out the malt miller. And there you go.
What yeast again?
Oh, what yeast did we use? Is it in here?
So I ask because the whole mash hopping thing, I hear about it around biotransforming yeasts, and you know, mash hopping unlocks somehow bound vials. I don't know how much is true or not, but usually it's used around biotransforming yeast. And a lot of the biotransforming yeast that we're aware of are English ale yeast. So that would be a very interesting genus should it have all that going on. But it sounds like it's a tasty beer either way. And I wish I knew. I wish I knew how tasty it was.
Let's see here. He was talking about, I can't remember. We were talking about thiolized yeast. We're talking about Omega Star Party, which is a Chico.
Yeah. So that makes sense for the whole mash hopping.
But they are not allowed to use GMO products. So he was talking about WOP-077. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Well, on the hop unlock, which is the yeast we use.
Oh, okay.
Which is a product from WHC Lab.
I kind of keep up with one thing in my life, and it's kind of beer. It's not the family. It's not the friends. It's kind of beer. I've never heard of hop unlock as a yeast. I'll have to look into that.
Maybe we'll do a show.
There you go. Or your friend John Blickman uses hop unlock.
It is a naturally cultivated thiol-producing liquid yeast containing enzymes that can help release bound thiols from hops and malt. More powerful aromas and flavors being unlocked and can open up with a much wider array of brewing options with less costly hop varieties. There you go.
Yeah.
I bet you know, our good buddy John Blickman knows a thing or two about hop unlock or anything else. You know, that dude knows everything, something about everything. He's one smart guy.
He makes great products.
Well, he does. And what's amazing about him is just the way his brain works as an engineer in creating new products. And, you know, so there's a lot of people who create brewing products that don't brew, but he actually brews himself. He uses the products that he makes. And then he's like, I don't like this, or I want to change this, or I want to make this even better. And so he's constantly updating and innovating, you know, a more innovative guy in equipment. I think the brewing world would be completely different if it wasn't for John Blickman. Now there's other equipment companies that have, you know, started creating new things, but I think, you know, he was kind of that on the forefront of really pushing instead of just making the same thing, the same usual equipment. It's like, I'm going to make new equipment. I'm going to make something completely different. So he was an engineer at Caterpillar, and you know, that's some serious engineers over there. And he took that, his God-given abilities, and has produced some amazing stuff. So check them out, BlickmanEngineering.com. They've been sponsoring us for 15 plus years. Check them out. If you don't mind, send them an email, feedback@BlickmanEngineering. Tell them, thank you, John Blickman, for paying for the show, so I don't have to. If you get anything of any value, take 5 minutes of your time. It doesn't even take 5 minutes. 2 minutes of your time. Rattle off a quick email saying, thank you very much. I appreciate it. If you just do that for me, I would be thankful, because guy deserves a little praise for sticking with us this long. It's a great guy. Check him out, BlickmanEngineering.com. All right, let's do this. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we will get in on questions right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new boil coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20 gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller, and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy All Grain Brewing System. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy. Easy.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're doing a live Q&A. I'm here with my good buddy Travis Comble, out in the Houston area. Award-winning homebrewer, tremendous friend, travel companion, you know, all the good stuff. All right, I figured we'd jump right in with a tough one here. Clayton, he says, it's a local homebrew shop, Windsor, Costa Mesa, and Anaheim locations. Those are all in Southern California, by the way. Is doing a Highland Park Timbo Pils, IPL, an India Pale Lager contest. HPB and Windsor are selling every contestant the same 5-gallon kit. I've been listening to the BN for over a decade, so it's a cinch, right? Nope. The batch 1055 calls for a soft lager 3470, and I read an article that used the same stuff, so I want to know how you use it. And again, this is January 2022, so I probably missed the contest, but I'm not that far behind. I've already brewed the beer, plenty of butter. I knew better, but the recipe they give, written by Highland Park, makes it sound so easy. I use 2 11.5 gram packs, which your Mr. Malty calculator says is great, but I've heard a podcast with somebody at Danstar, and she ran several tests with varying gravity and pitch rates, and most off flavors came in under threshold. My butter was not below threshold. Haha. She said that the dry yeast has a high sterols, and they don't recommend oxygenating or rehydration on the initial pitch. Just pitch the right amount. Highland Park recommended a lot of zinc, which you echoed in your article. Not a lot of zinc.
Right. It's a tiny bit. That's a lot.
It's a microscopic amount.
Yeah.
I pitched at like 52, I assume Fahrenheit, held for 2 days, then rose 2-ish, again, I assume Fahrenheit, per day to 65, where I racked to a keg to dry hop. Diacetyl rest and hop creep rest for 3 days, then dropped like 8 degrees a day to 40 degrees. Again, I assume Fahrenheit. His questions. Do you rehydrate? Do you do a starter? When is it best to oxygenate if I rehydrate? And then when oxygenate if I don't? How does dry hopping affect your lagering schedule? You mentioned recirculating your hops for 3 hours and getting rid of the hops. Don't the hops have to settle first? Or do you filter them somehow? Should I follow your calculator or pitch more? I was thinking of going with 3 to 4 packs instead of 2, or just go with a liquid version and do a starter and oxygenate. I know you said one question. I'm sorry, but I either going to rebrew this upcoming weekend or brew a different lager because I'm not a Mosaic hop fan and I want your help. I did already get rid of the yeast from that batch, so repitching isn't an option. Hugs and kisses, Clayton. Well, Clayton. All right. So
he has a spare bottle to send in.
From 2022, maybe.
Right. The diacetyl might have settled out by now.
So here's the thing. The Mr. Malt calculator. So every time, you know, someone from Danstar or somebody from White Labs, or somebody from Y Yeast or somebody from Imperial or somebody from any of the yeast companies says, hey, we did these tests and this is what we found. It's like, I'm really happy for you that you did your tests in your lab with fresh yeast and that gave you a certain result. I 100% believe you, and I guarantee you they're not lying to you. They're telling you the truth. They are trying to help people as much as possible. The reality is, though, that I wish all the people producing yeast would you know, keep in mind is that their yeast, like when you send out beer as a commercial brewer, it gets abused. So it gets shipped to, you know, a homebrew shop. Not all of them are as good as, you know, the greatest homebrew shops. Some of them, it's one person working, they're slammed, you know, it's totally busy, a box of yeast comes in and it sits there. And I've been in homebrew shops where there's a box of, you know, it's 110 degrees inside the shop and there's a box of yeast sitting there and it is all 100% room temperature. Eventually it makes it into the fridge. Sometimes I'll open up one of these fridges, I'll reach inside and it's hot inside. It's not cooling at all. Something went wrong with their fridge. Who knows when? But it hasn't been, you know, fixed. And, you know, that's an issue. So it can impact the viability of the yeast. It can impact, you know, the dry yeasts are pretty durable, but even then, you know, storing them in a refrigerator extends the life. And a lot of homebrew shops don't. They just sit out there hot. So the Mr. Malty calculator, the reason I have that the way I have it is because if you follow that, you will always get good results. And, you know, there's times when, now, if the yeast is totally dead, there's nothing I can do to help you there. But generally, the way viability works, and when I did that, I went out and bought samples of yeast from all over the place, checked it out. I went to some homebrew shops where their yeast had hit their expiry date, and I asked them if I could take it and if they'd give it to me. They did. I told them what I was doing, and we did all sorts of testing and came up with this formula that if you follow it, it's going to work. You're gonna get good results. You're not going to waste the rest of your ingredients. So that's why that one is going to err on the side of more yeast. Now, if the Mr. Malty one tells you 2 11.5 gram packs are enough, then I would not go to 3 or 4 11.5 gram packs. It's going to be too much. Would you hurt your beer? Probably not. You have to put a lot of yeast in a beer in order to overpitch. It's very difficult to overpitch. It's possible, but it's difficult. So I wouldn't just do that. I think your issue is probably somewhere else. Let's see. He says, do you rehydrate? Yes, I do. They say, oh, you don't really need to. Maybe they've come up with some new miracle way of making yeast that doesn't help things when you rehydrate, but
they're saying you don't need to because they're saying you don't need as much yeast as you say they need. Mm-hmm. But if someone's following your calculator and you say they need 2 packs, they need 2 healthy packs or 2 packs on that date, not right. 2 packs that were thrown into work with all these, you know, all this osmotic pressure, et cetera, right?
Right. Because what I've seen, and I saw from Clayton Cohn, I think he said that you lose about 50% of the yeast when you just sprinkle it on the wort. They said that they've, you know, improved things so it, you know, they don't lose 50%. So I don't know. I still think it's such a simple thing to do to rehydrate your yeast.
Do you want to guess how much you lost, or do you just want to do it the right way?
Right.
Do you do a starter? If I was using dry yeast and I had the right amount, I rehydrated, I would not do a starter with it. I would not, if I was using, let's see here. When is best to oxygenate if I rehydrate and when to oxygenate if I don't? Again, they say you don't need oxygen even. I would oxygenate just before pitching the yeast.
Right. Especially with the lager, right?
In there and I just pour the yeast in. Right. How does dry hopping affect your lagering schedule? Well, if you want to dry hop at a specific temperature, then you can, you know, dry hop at that point, whatever your chilling schedule is. So if you want to dry hop at 40 degrees Fahrenheit, well, then you can wait till you get to 40 degrees Fahrenheit and then dry hop. If you want to dry hop at 65 Fahrenheit and after your diacetyl rest or anywhere in between, you can do that. The thing that really kind of messes with people in dry hopping is if you want to repitch your yeast and not having a bunch of dry hops in your yeast. So that's kind of the only thing. So follow your calculator, pitch more, follow the calculator. There you go. And then getting back to zinc, not a lot of zinc, a small amount. I think we did a show about zinc and how much zinc and all that. If not, we'll do another one because people keep asking a lot of questions about zinc.
Over zinc would under attenuate more so than the butter issue, right?
Yeah, it will.
The yeast drops out.
It is harmful to the yeast. So a high zinc environment, it would be like adding too much of, you know, copper or too much, you know, any mineral.
No idea what too much copper my beer would do. So I saw one thing in there, Jamil, and I only think of this because of you. He did a diacetyl rest, not a diacetyl test.
Hmm. Nice.
Right?
Right.
I mean, I was afraid of a diacetyl test until you said, you got to do it.
Yes.
I hit a string of lagers, and now my diacetyl test pro. It's not that big a deal. Right. Fortunately for me, I've got the old White Labs tubes, mm-hmm. the vials.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll pull samples. I'll put, you know, one room temp, one at 160, and I do it for all my lagers.
Right.
And I get diacetyl, then I wait a day or two, and yeah, I get no diacetyl.
You open the cap up, give it a sniff, yeah. And you smell butter, and it's like, oh, so my diacetyl rest isn't complete yet.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I say correct. Sorry, because I learned it from you. But that's what I saw in Clayton's right. Clayton's notes is that he does a diacetyl rest, right. But not a diacetyl test.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's excellent. So glad you brought that up because I missed that. Yes, you definitely want to do a diacetyl test. Forced ferments and diacetyl tests—they're so easy and. They cost essentially nothing to do. You know, you have a 50 mil screw cap container, and you can do a diacetyl test. And that'll tell you whether you got diacetyl in there. The other thing is, boy, did you see what temperature he started at? He said he started
pretty low.
52. Yeah.
Not low for lagers, but low for IPL.
Right.
But I mean, that should be fine, right? I mean, he's got good fermentation. He didn't say what his final gravity was, did he?
No, he did not.
Because that would tell us if the beer finished well, which again goes back to zinc and or fermentation profile, his temperature.
You know, a lot of times.
I bet he rebrewed it by now and he made a great beer.
He probably won.
And Clayton should write back to us and tell us how good that, well, write back to you. And tell us how good that rebrew was.
Now we don't know what we're talking about.
And send a bottle in so we can taste it.
Let's see here. All right. We're doing on time. Doing all right. He's asking about brewing non-alcoholic beers. Hey, my brewing brothers. I wonder if you could steer me in the right direction. Unfortunately, late last fall, I was struck down by a viral phenomena. That attacked my heart, and now I suffer from congestive heart failure at the young age of 45. Oh, sorry to hear that, brother. As you can imagine, I can no longer drink my homebrew or much alcoholic beer since I am restricted to a low-sodium diet, which also includes a very low amount of alcohol that I can consume. Sucks, yes, but out of the homebrew hobby, maybe not. I noticed several craft non-alcoholic beers are starting to show up at our local beer stores and was wondering if it's possible to still brew from home But instead of the high octane stuff, could I create a low version that will make me happy as well as my doctor? Is it just a simple matter of turning up the heat after fermentation to burn off the alcohol, or is there a trick in creating a non-alcoholic beverage we could do at home? Any advice would be helpful. Thanks for all the wonderful information you have provided me in the past. Let's hope that I can still enjoy this wonderful hobby in the future. Might not be able to drink those beers you are eloquently describing in your podcast, but at least I can still imagine them one by one. Cheers, Ed in Springfield, Illinois. Ed, yeah, the way to go about it. So there's, we actually did a show on non-alcoholic beers, producing non-alcoholic beers. Should be somewhere in the archives. It's all available still, all for free, thanks to Blickman Engineering. But for a home brewer, the easiest way is perhaps to, I was just talking to the folks at Oak Park Brewing, and the way that they were doing theirs is 180 degrees Fahrenheit on their mash temp. So they're mashing at 180 degrees Fahrenheit and then fermenting, and then you could water down to get the alcohol level less, or you can heat it up depending on how much alcohol is in there. And if it's too much for you, you could heat it up and drive off the alcohol that way. You have to get it to like about 175 Fahrenheit before the ethanol will evaporate. But the problem with that is the beer kind of tastes cooked. If you're real delicate with it, if you do it under vacuum, if you can pull a vacuum, it makes it even. You can go with much lower temperature and it comes off much faster. So there's charts out there to tell you how much vacuum, how much heat you need to apply. But that'll work too. And then you don't have to apply as much heat. And that works well. If you just use straight heat at atmospheric pressure, it tastes cooked. So, heat staling is what we call it. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't. Because, I wish I did have something to add to it. I mean, athletics out there making a straight line of non-alcoholics, and I haven't looked into what they were doing. I did read Ed's question in advance. Thanks for forwarding it to me. And I wish I had advice for Ed on how to handle that, but I just don't.
Yeah, they have, there's machines that, there's vacuum stills mm-hmm. that are set up to do it, like we mentioned. Okay. And then there's also membranes.
That makes a flavor. So does that make membrane sounds like a good idea.
So essentially like an RO membrane. And what it does is filter out the water and alcohol, or the alcohol, and takes, the alcohol out, leaves behind most of the water and all the flavor compounds. And then
right. You
water that resultant thing that you collected, you water that back to tasting normal, right? And then the alcohol's out of it.
Your buddy John Blitman needs to sell one of these membranes.
I actually took a look online, and you can actually buy the membranes. They're pretty expensive, but you can buy these membranes that will separate out alcohol, and then it's just a matter of producing enough pressure to force
right. The
liquid across it, and so
between polar and pressure and molecule size, I mean, water's polar, alcohol's not.
Yeah.
Where do all the flavor compounds land? And of course, some of the flavor compounds are more like an alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, getting a balance on that.
So
but seriously, if John did it, it'd be affordable and it'd work better.
There you go. All right. Will, he says he's a brewing noob. He says, hey guys, love the show. I'm still new to brewing. Well, and 5 years later, you're not. Still new to brewing, still doing extract. I just finished listening to the adjunct show and have a question. If I don't have a handful of grain to add to the mini mash to help the conversion of my adjunct, can I use some extract and how much? Thanks in advance, guys. Keep up the good work and brew strong. No, you cannot.
I was going with no. Yeah.
I could be wrong here, but the extract.
No diastatic power left.
In have no diastatic power whatsoever. Yes.
All right. Yeah.
Because it does get boiled, it does get concentrated.
Denatured.
Yeah, so it's denatured the enzyme, so that won't work. It's the enzymes in there. You could, instead of you know, worrying about the handful of grain, you can actually buy enzymes. You could buy a, you know, an alpha amylase or a beta amylase, and you can actually just, you know, throw a few drops in there with your mini mash, and that would work. That's probably the best way. If you, you know, have a handful of grain to add, you know, with a high diastatic power to add to your adjuncts and all that, that'll break it down too. But these days of enzymes and bottles, I think you probably could just go that route.
I don't know if it's been 5 years, but John was definitely talking about him a few years back. And when John was talking about him, I couldn't find him, but you can find him now. Right. There are a crazy amount of enzymes out there now. I mean, I've got a brute enzyme in my fridge. I'm almost afraid to use it. I think it's going to suck the protein out of everything in my house. So, yeah. That's an outstanding concept.
If you don't enjoy your protein being sucked, then avoid the enzymes.
Classic. Excellent.
Yep. That's why they pay me the big money.
Absolutely. That's why I stick around.
Speaking of big money, you know, if you go to brewcheddar.com, you don't have to spend big money because they have reasonable pricing on all their ingredients. It's all fresh. They got an excellent selection. Our good friends at brewcheddar.com, they're out there. They got a physical store there in Sparks, Nevada. It's right next to Reno. If you're ever up there, you got to check it out. Wonderful location. They got their own little mini bar in there with, you know, local brews on tap. It's one of the best homebrew shop experiences I've ever had. And Josh and RJ, wonderful folks that you should get to know if you enjoy homebrewing. Check them out, brewcheddar.com. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll have more of your questions right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking all your Q&A questions. Keep sending them in to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. Or if you listen live, and you can just ask them right in the chat, and we will get right on those things. Let's see. Rob in Lone Pine. He asks, I'm about 6 months behind on shows, so forgive me if this has been done. I'm a little perplexed by how the BJCP entry beers are processed, judged, and ranked. I'm not a BJCP judge, but I have just started entering beers. My 2015 beers earned 41 points and 39 points at the LA County Fair, and 42, 38 points at a small regional fair. So seem very consistent, 41, 42, 39, 38. This is great, but I didn't place. I later learned that my group was sorted into a much broader category, which encompassed IPAs with barley wines, and the barley wines took first, second, and best in show. I thought each BJCP category was given individual merit, but with such judging methods, how can lighter beer styles ever compete against the bold and the beautiful? I'm hoping Jay-Z and JP can provide tips, tricks, and the dirty on America's beer competitions and how to win. Love always, Rob and Lone Pine. Travis, you're entering competitions currently. How much of this category combining do you see?
It depends on the side of the competition, obviously. It happens all the time. I mean, for instance, gentleman's name, Rob. Yeah. So, Rob, I mean, I've got various medals for my double IPA. I lose most often to my own barley wine. Now, that's double IPA, not IPA. How do I know what would happen if they combine those two tables? I don't know. You kind of like, okay, that's a small competition. Let me go for that one, get medals. I'm not saying you did that, but I might do something like that. They're going to combine tables often, unfortunately. I honestly think they shouldn't for smaller competitions, but they do that. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly legit on their end. Seems to me if they bought 38 sets of medals, they should award 38 sets of medals. I feel your pain. I really do. Jamil, I mean, is there any, I mean, you've been on the pro level. We've been on the pro level when there's thousands of entries and they say no gold and the whole auditorium boos.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, I mean, I know it happens. It is legit that it happens, but nobody likes it except for, the people who do the judging who feel the need to combine it. I got passion over here. You might have facts and better input. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. So when you're running a competition, if you need to set up another table and another set of judges, mm-hmm. it can be difficult because you're counting on volunteers to come in and do the judging.
Yeah.
And it's not that, you know, they don't want to, it's that it would make the competition unable to, you know, go forward because then all of a sudden you need to increase it and you don't have that many entries. And let's say that there's, I mean, at what point do you cut it off? Let's say, oh, I've got, seven and, six. I got a flight of seven. I got a flight of six. I'm going to combine them into a 13, which is pretty much the maximum that you're supposed to be allowed to do. I'll combine that into a 13.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think you should keep that a seven and a six. Okay.
So we're on the same page.
Well, let's say.
But.
You have a category of nine or 10, and you have a category of one. Should the one be judged all by itself? Should you seat three more judges and judge the one beer on its own and decide gold. Whether it's medal worthy or not?
It's gold.
Or right. Do they get a win for being the only entry? Or should it be combined with the closest category they could find since it's only one beer and it just needs to go in this other category?
If you run a race and you're the only person running the race, and you win, right?
You come in first. Well, let's see.
I'm pretty sure you win.
Let's say you complete the race. At my age,
you don't?
At my age and weight, maybe I don't. You know, do I get a participation medal if I don't cross the finish line?
You get the free shirt and some beers if you make it there. You know, call the Uber to bring you to end so you get the free beers.
There you go.
Yeah, so, I'm sorry. We've argued his point, not against his point, unfortunately. Right.
It
happens.
It happens. I would like to see them do it only in more extreme circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe the BJCP should come up with a ruling saying, look, you know, if you've got five entries, you know, run it as a separate category or something.
Right. I think there is a rule and it allows for it. And the concept of the one entry is extreme. The reality might be three to five, but I've never run across a competition only had three to five IPAs. Come on. To five IPAs.
Well, IPAs. You know, might have been, you know, triple IPA that got, and generally what they do is like triple IPA ends up
specialty
in barley
IPA.
Wine, or double IPA or whatever ends up in barley wine.
It does. Yeah. 22 is double IPA, barley wine, American strong ale, maybe one more.
Right.
21 is almost every single variation of IPA. Mm-hmm. And any specialty IPA, double, triple, single session falls into 21.
So a lot of times those will get mixed in with the regular IPAs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem? Right. They're all IPAs. Right. So but I'll see it very frequently is something like light American lager gets mixed in with all the other lagers.
Or Hellas.
There tends not to be that many lagers in most competitions.
Right. And that's a bigger crime to me.
They all get, you know, compacted into one category.
Yeah. That's
so
a shame.
It's just, you know, if we could pay judges and there was a limitless supply of judges and time and money, then I, you know, this wouldn't happen, but it's just, you know, it's kind of the nature of the beast. It's unfortunate. Yeah. And I think the thing to do though is, you know, brew a fantastic beer to where knowledgeable judges cannot, you know, I've been in competitions, judging competitions where I'm like, this is perfect. I know, you know, it's you know, light American lager, and it's in the IPA category, but damn, that's perfect. And, you know, that's the winner. And, you know, judges will pick them out. So the other thing is 41 points, 39 points. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's good scoring sheets.
If it's a good sized competition, the winners are probably, you know, 45, 40, 46, you know, somewhere around there. So that's a higher score, but you know, it goes to 50. So there, you know, you're 20% off of the, you know, of the top there. So, you know,
and the other side of that is, unfortunately, a 40 point IPA goes against a 35 point IPA that wasn't quite the style sometimes, but was really damn tasty. Because in the second round, they don't have to judge against style necessarily. They should.
Well, they do.
There's no score sheet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think, I mean, I'd like to have this guy's beer. I'd love to have it. I mean, 40 point averaging IPA, I'm all about it. But I mean, barley wine, can you beat it? You can beat it. It depends on the judges. It depends on the beer.
There tends to be far better IPAs out there than barley wines. A lot of barley wines are not well brewed.
Right.
Yeah.
Age hides half the flaws, not all the flaws.
There you go. All right. Let's see here.
Yeah.
Attenuation questions. Simon asks, hey guys, I am having a problem with my beer's attenuating completely. Come on, you guys need to proofread your questions.
These are your worshipers, Jamil. Be nice to them.
I have a Vienna lager I'm fermenting right now, and my final gravity has been holding steady at 10.18. I'd like to get it down to 10.12, like the recipe says. The recipe was taken from Jamil's Vienna lager, but I had to use a couple of different items because my homebrew store didn't have some items. Recipe ingredients, malt, 4 pounds, Pilsner extract, 6 pounds, Munich grains, 2 ounces, Carafa Special 2, Saaz, 1.5 ounce, Saaz, 1/2 ounce, Imperial yeast, Global, mashed at 152 for 1 hour and 20 minutes, did an iodine test.
Do you recall your Vienna recipe close enough to notice the differences? Because I didn't pull it out.
Yeah, it's close enough, I guess. Original gravity is 1052. Pitch the yeast at 55 degrees, I assume Fahrenheit. Oxygen with pure O2 for 90 seconds. Fermented at 52. I did the de-rest when gravity dropped to 1021. 75% of fermentation done.
That's the thing that jumps out to me the most.
The Kreuzen dropped at 65 degrees. Fahrenheit. I waited 2 to 3 days to check the gravity. I had a lot of my beers stop at 1018 or so and not reach the final gravity it was supposed to be. What am I doing wrong? Any suggestions would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, Simon.
Would you bring your lager that warm that soon?
Well, I don't think that's the issue because the hotter and the sooner you get it hot, more it's going to attenuate generally.
Okay.
Unless you get too, you get like up in the 90s and then it shuts down.
Okay.
The thing here is, he says, I've had a lot of my beer stop at 1018 or so.
Yeah. That's curious also, right?
That seems kind of odd.
Right.
And so it makes me think, you know, one, I would, anytime you're having troubles with your brews, one of the first things to do is validate the equipment you're measuring with. So, for example, your hydrometer, you know, put it in water. Doesn't even need to be distilled water unless the water that comes out of your tap is so.
It should be within 0.01, right? Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you're going to be reading 1.0 or 1.01 plus or minus the error on your
hydrometer. Check your hydrometer at temperature and check to see if it's close to zero with water. If it's not, that is an issue, you know, where your reading is way off. You could be off, you know, 006 on your hydrometer pretty easy. As that gets tapped, the paper in the thing move up and down, right? So the way you correct it is you can try carefully tap, 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 well, one way or the other, and the paper will slide. And you can adjust your hydrometer that way. It's rare that you see them that far off. Usually they're off just by, you know, a point or two, and you can either just make a note of it or, you know, correct it. That it would be off 6 would be extreme. What he should be doing, which you mentioned earlier, was do a forced ferment. So when you get your wort set up, set some aside, pitch a bunch of yeast in it, and see if you can do a forced ferment and then measure that. And if that is turning out to be 10-12, then you have a problem with your other parts of your brewing. So you're not enough oxygen, not enough yeast, not enough healthy yeast. He says he did an iodine test. I was thinking, you know, that Munich, you just end up with a bunch of, you know, unfermented starches or unconverted starches, and maybe that was part of the problem. But he says he did an iodine test.
Is 6 pounds minute that much higher than 4 pounds Pilsner extract is maybe 5 pounds Pils malt. 6 pounds Munich versus 5 pounds Pils malt. Again, I didn't bring up your recipe. I'm not saying I've never seen it because I've seen your recipe, but I just didn't compare it. But Munich is relatively highly fermentable, right?
It will self-convert. It does have diastatic power, but less than
crap. So and his base malt's extract.
Right, but he said he said he
iodine test
did a mash at 152 for an hour and 20 minutes and then did an iodine test. And I'm assuming the iodine test told him it was all converted.
Right.
So I can't think that was the problem. Sounds like he's doing all the right stuff, oxygen, everything else. It all seems like I've not used the global yeast, so I don't know about that. But I think, again, the thing to do in this case would be to do a forced ferment. You do the forced ferment, that's going to tell you what it can attenuate to. Usually general fermentation will be short a couple of points from that. And, you know, if your forced ferment turns out to be 10-16 or 10-17, you know, you're attenuating all the way, and it's a recipe adjustment that you need to do. He also doesn't mention where that Pilsner extract comes from. So some of the extracts are less fermentable than others. It depends on how the manufacturer set it up. So it could be that it just won't ferment, and what you should be adding is, you know, a different extract, or you should add some simple sugars or something to get it to attenuate down if you want it to attenuate further. Yeah, 10-18 is a bit high, but I imagine it's probably not that far off. It may be a combination of things, hydrometer off a little bit, and you know, it didn't attenuate fully, etc. So you're closer than you think. But again, do a forced ferment first thing. And if the forced ferment tells you that it should be getting down to 10-12 or, you know, 10-10 or something like that, and it's not, then you got to start looking at some of these other things. That should get you there. All right, let's do one more short break. When we come back, we'll wrap up with a couple of your questions right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're doing your Q&A questions. If you send in your questions to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com, we will answer them. Eventually, we will answer them. Or you can listen live like Patrick did, and you can ask and interact with your hosts during the show. Ask your questions right there.
Never met Patrick, but I think he's a really cool guy.
I mean, Patrick's one of my favorite people in the world. I got to admit, you know, he brews incredible beer. He's generous with his time, knowledgeable, really good looking guy, you know, handsome, generous, kind to a fault. Yeah. You know, Patrick.
That's outstanding. Really is.
Apparently he lives in Nebraska.
So is he that far? Where's Bookman at? In
Indiana.
All right. I'm lost. Sorry. I know where Houston is.
They're both in the United States. If that helps.
Maybe that much too. It does help. It does help. Thank you. Sorry.
All right. Let's see here. Ben, he says, hey guys, first of all, you guys are badasses. Second, I have to thank you guys for all the awesome free information and dick jokes I heard over listening to pretty much all of your episodes in the last 6 months. And lastly, I'd love to ask a favor, and sadly, no, it is not a sexual favor. Dang it. But beer related, as I just found out, I can go and live and work in Australia for a year and decided I better before I get too old. Anyway, I was wondering if you guys have any connections for a job in maybe the hop farms down there or a homebrew shop or brewery. Any help would be amazing. Brew strong, Ben.
I hope he's not still holding out.
Who knows? Maybe he went down to Australia and, you know, he got taken away by a dingo. You know, maybe his baby got taken by a dingo. I bring this up just because, one, I promise to answer every question, and two, I think it may be helpful for other people that are also in a similar situation and they're looking for, you know, a way to find, you know, possible jobs or whatever. And so couple of things. One, which he did, is reach out to everybody you know and tell them you're looking for a job in Australia. Social media, all your friends, just let everybody know. Here's what I'm planning on doing. If you happen to know anybody, let me know. And you'd be shocked at how many people will, you know, come and tell you. It's like, yep, I know this guy. I know that guy. I know that woman, you know, this woman. I know, you know, this shop owner, that shop owner. So reach out to everybody you can. Google is your friend, you know, Google. And if you're going to be in Australia, Google homebrew shops in Australia, hop farms in Australia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, cold call, you know, send, you know, take your time, you know, polish up your letter, you know, have somebody else read it to make sure that there's no typos. It doesn't sound like a serial killer, stuff like that, you know, where, you know, craft a really nice letter, you know, include, you know, maybe your resume, you know, showing that, you know, you've accomplished things or you've studied or whatever, you know, whatever abilities you have, or, you know, write a nice letter just saying how, you know, how hardworking you are and how dedicated you are to the craft and all that. And cold call, send them out to all those. Once you Google, they all have info at or, you know, some sort of contact email. Send it out and ask everybody. It's like, I would like a job. You know, I'm willing to work hard. And you'd be shocked at how well that works. I will say, I do have a contact for you. That's a little late for you, I assume. But my good friend John Preston at Grain and Grape in Yarraville, wonderful guy. When I was out there in Melbourne, he took me to the Tigers game. We watched the Tigers game. I had a horrible, like, 105 degree fever during the game, and I was kind of losing my mind and didn't really know where I was. But I remember going and seeing a little bit of the Tigers game there, and it was a blast. Really great guy, great shop, really, really fantastic if you check him out. John Preston, Grain and Grape, Yarraville. I will tell you, anybody out there, you know, you're near Yarraville, check him out. I was a big fan of the Grain and Grape.
But you know, you've mentioned in more than one show your philosophy in general on how to get a job and how to show up and where to be and so forth. So where, you know, Ben just asked this question and didn't get a direct answer for, yeah, who cares how long? No big deal. But you often advise, you know, show up.
7+ years.
Who cares?
But hey, it's for the other listeners who may have a similar question. And exactly. What I've learned is somebody asks a question, there's lots of other people who have the same question.
But you've advised similarly through the years. Show up. Mm-hmm. On time is late.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. And be there early.
Right. Hopefully you're willing to do more than you think you're willing to do, or more than you think they want you to do or need you to do. And hopefully you don't show up saying, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. Because I can promise you, when you show up for any job, you don't know what you're doing until they tell you what they want you to do.
Well, and have some humility, you know, go in. Absolutely. And it's like, I want to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, in your letter to these folks, tell them, it's like, I want to learn. I have some experience, but I know there is a lot I can learn from you, which is why I'm reaching out to you. I want to, you know, better myself and be an important part of this industry. And you have knowledge and, you know, quality that I want to emulate in my career. That's why I want to work with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, even if you think they're horrible. Well, then if you think they're horrible, don't
apply.
Don't apply. Right? But yeah, right. Don't go in there and go like, yeah, here's my homebrew. Here's how your beer sucks and my brew is great.
Go ahead and get a small business loan and open up your own brewery if that's right. Your case.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. That is a fact.
I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, if your beer is that good, just do it. But right, you're not going to get a job with that attitude, is all I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, there are places where, and I'll also say this, every business out there could use some improvement. Mm-hmm. Every business out there is not doing everything absolutely perfect all the time.
Exactly.
You know, people who are not in the business sometimes, they have it in their minds that they know everything and they would do it this way and all that. It's like, no. Until you've walked a mile in their shoes, don't be telling them how to do everything. Go in and just show them a little respect. And, you know, that's the reason a lot of homebrewers get turned down. I hear it from a lot of other brewers. They'll be like, yeah, they'll come in and they'll pour me a glass of their homebrew, which is nasty. And then they'll tell me about how my beers could improve. And if I only did this, if I only did that, it's just like, it's all I could keep from punching them, you know, like, yep. Don't go in and, you know, tell people that, you know, their beer sucks.
The rest of your friends are wonderful, Jim Mill.
Right.
Sorry. Anyway. Yeah. So, but the lesson to learn here is, if you want some really good sage advice in your career, think 7 years ahead.
There you go. Right. You should have asked this question back in 2008. I don't know what the hell's the matter with you, Ben. You should be more on the ball. How are you going to get a job if you're not 8 years in advance? Trevor asks, hey guys, thanks for always for the show and taking the time to answer questions. Is there a preferred sequence to when certain ingredients get mashed in? If you're using acidulated malt, should that go in before or after mineral adjustments? Is it better to mash in base malt before darker malts to minimize tannin extraction from higher temp strike water? Cheers, Trevor. What's your thoughts?
Drawing a blank. I mean, I don't. I add it all in up front.
Right.
I just do it. And if the recipe's not right, I adjust the recipe. So, yeah, I'm waiting for your answer, honestly, because your experience is far more vast than mine is.
Right. So, you know, there's the tannins are essentially more or less equal across all the malts. I imagine it may be possible for higher kilning to affect the tannins not a grain, possibly. I don't know. Some of the grains do not have husks, are huskless.
Right.
And have a vastly lower tannin present in those, because the tannins are mainly from the husk of the malt.
Can we maybe get past Trevor's question on tannins? And you're well familiar with, you know, some people like to add their roast malt towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
And despite tannins or otherwise,
right,
do you feel there's really a reason to add some coffee grinds towards the end, aka roasted malts,
no,
versus through the whole 60 minutes?
No, that's I won't say it's stupid, but I think that people are missing the point that you can just add less.
Okay. Yeah, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
But you almost did say stupid, but
no, it's not stupid. But
no.
It's just yeah, you know, it's a time, you know, and a liquid and a temperature thing.
Contact.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
It's not that you're somehow extracting something, you know, unwanted, mm-hmm, by leaving it in there longer. It's the same thing.
It's not tannins. And that's how I felt. But again, your experience is far more vast than mine is. So if you're getting too much roast, don't back off on the time, back off on the roast.
Right. Just use less.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's too roasty. It's like, oh, I'll put it in later. It's like,
put less in. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then you have to worry about it. I always put everything in at one time. I would mill everything and I would actually mix. I'd do base malt and then I'd throw in my specialty grains and then I'd do more base malt and I'd have it all mixed in. So when it was all, you know, mixed throughout the whole thing, the same thing, acidulated malt before, after mineral adjustments, all the grain goes in, then the mineral adjustments and pH checks and all that. Base malt for darker malts all at the same time.
So, and you've gone back to homebrewing. I mean, I know you're brewing bitters and so forth. Your strike water, et cetera, is some form of filtered, but not treated. It's not hot liquor. It's just water.
Right. So what I'm doing now is my instant hot water heater. I just hook up a hose to that thing. Mm-hmm. And, I run through a carbon block and, into the kettle. So I'm starting off with 120 some odd degree water, so it gets me going quicker, and then I, you know, hit the burners and I get it up to temp. I will do an acid adjustment to drop the pH down to around 5.6 or 5.7. It depends on the recipe. And then once you add the grains, they pull the pH down a little further, depending on the grains you're using,
mm-hmm,
whether it's roast, et cetera. And then,
but all we need to chop that piece, that little piece right there, we need to chop and put out on, because that's going to blow everybody away that's doing RO.
Oh, yeah. So
with RO, you make your water first, you add your malt, you check your pH. You're not doing RO, you're doing carbon block, but your water quality is significantly better than Houston water quality.
Right.
I can't just carbon block here. Yeah, that's outstanding. That's what you do, and that's what you can do.
Well,
it really is.
But if you use RO, your pH must be really low.
It's like nothing and nothing, and any tweak makes it crazy because there's nothing in there.
Right. Well, I mean, once you add your grain.
Oh, when I add my water.
Well, I guess if it's all pale. Well, yeah. Yeah. If I was using RO, I would first add my mineral adjustments to make my water.
Yes.
Then I would add my grains, and then I would do any adjustments after that.
Right. That's what I do typically.
Yeah.
I add less acid than expected, plus my adjustments to make my water, add my grain, and then check my pH, obviously, before I add any more acid.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would add all my minerals, or at least some of the minerals before that. Yeah, the traditional thing is, you know, there's already minerals in your water, you add your grains, and then you do your other mineral adjustments after that. You can do it prior to that, but some of the minerals won't really have any effect, or they'll drop out to the bottom if you don't have the grains in there to, that the grains affect the pH and the buffering of the solution.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, I have a paint mixer and I try to mix them in sometimes. And sometimes they don't mix in. Because I set my water up the night before because not intentionally a plug, my Anvil Foundry, I can tell it to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and bring up to mash town.
Mm-hmm.
Or +2 degrees, 3 degrees. And so I come in at 6 a.m. and I readjust the temperature and dump my malt in. So I've made my water the night before. My hot liquor is in my mash tun waiting for me.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it mixes, sometimes it doesn't want to mix. It's just so much, right? I mean, it needs that malt to offset it.
Right. Well, so you might want to put in, maybe half of your mineral additions into your RO or some, or 3/4, and then the rest, or, 2/3, 1/3, and the rest after adding your grain.
And so you're probably about to announce your next question. Patrick has something in the chat. If you have a chance to look at it before we move on to the next, or we just move on to the next and come back to Patrick.
I'm out of questions. I think almost out of show here. Let's see. Patrick says, any advice on scaling up roast malts or other tips on brewing larger batches? Our home club gets the occasional invite to brew 2-barrel batches at our local brewery. The scaling from 5 to 10-gallon batches doesn't seem to be linear adjustment. Efficiency changes I expected, but the roasted malts require adjustment on our imperial stout. I think we did a show on scale.
You did. And I have one comment before you correct me. I like to go first, because once you say the right thing, I have nothing to add.
You sound like we're married at this point.
I got a
one comment before you correct me. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I see how it may sound. I say it lovingly, just like a marriage.
Yes, dear.
So I would look at equipment differences more. I mean, because what Patrick's saying, that's not a very large scale different. 5 to 10 gallons, that's going to be more the equipment. When you go maybe 10 barrels, maybe that's more than just equipment. Because I often assume you used to get better efficiency than me at Heretic on your mash. I can get low 80s on my Foundry, high 70s on my mash done Ice Chest. But you told me Heretic was getting low 80s, I think, efficiency on mash.
Like 85.
That's mid 80s.
We ended up pushing up a little higher than that, maybe 88 at one point.
So that's
we never really cared about efficiency.
Right. But it makes a difference on your extract.
Yes.
Right.
So,
not just the sugars, but also the colors and the other flavors.
Right. And so I've always said, scaling beer recipes is linear, mainly because people talk about hop efficiency. I'm like, no, that's the same. If you have a wort at a given gravity and you add X amount of hops and you boil it, you're going to get the same, unless you're not reaching 212 degrees in your homebrew or not in your commercial. And, it's the whirlpool time and the knockout time in the commercial that is missing from homebrew that ends up with a much higher efficiency on the hops, or much higher bittering extraction on the hops, because it takes hours and a homebrew is done in 15 minutes or 30 minutes.
Right.
You throw the immersion chiller in there and it pretty much stops. That's where the difference comes in scaling those. It's not some efficiency of hopping. Now, what you're saying though, Travis, is absolutely right. If you're scaling, a batch, 10 gallon to 2-barrel doesn't, that seems really Like, it shouldn't be that big a difference. I would wonder, well, all right. I've got multiple thought paths going here. One, I'd be like, well, you know, is the water the same? Is everything else the same? There's other issues. Are the grains the same? Because one manufacturer's, one maltster's chocolate malt or black malt is different than another one. One, there's black malts that are 350 Lovibond. There's black malts that are 650 Lovibond. Yeah, I mean, they can be different. If you're not using the same ingredients, exact same ingredients, they can vary. They can even vary. A maltster batch to batch can vary considerably. So that could be an issue. But what Travis is referring to is that the efficiency of the extract for a brewery, if you are extracting more sugars and you get, X number of points per gallon from your grain, and you're extracting more sugars, you're using less of those grains to get the same amount of sugars. If you scale everything to match that, so you don't need as much, and you're going with, well, I only need, 5% of roast barley. Well, your roast barley amount has gone down too. So you can end up with not enough roast barley character in that, because the roast barley, you're not, generally speaking, you shouldn't experience a higher extraction or lower extraction in the commercial versus the homebrew. Unless you're putting it in different times or whatever, that should extract pretty much the same. It may not be, but it should pretty much extract the same. So if you're using less of it because the base malt is extracting better on the commercial system and you're doing a percentage, you're going to end up with not enough, roast malt character in your finished beer on the commercial system. It could be the reverse, but that's harder to justify.
I think it looks like the reverse. If you back off the base malt mm-hmm. and you hold your barley malt, then you've really increased your percent.
Right.
So it looks reverse. It looks like, I got crazy amounts of that roast barley.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, but it's also 8% now because you backed off your base malt. It's very interesting.
The other factors you need to go, which you were referring to earlier, was depends on the equipment, right? So yeah. If somebody's doing brew in a bag, they're going to get less rinsing probably than the commercial one where you're sparging on top, you're fly sparging, and you're rinsing more of the roast product out. So that could be an issue too. But in general, it should pretty much be linear, except for if you're changing your grist amounts on efficiency, that's what kind of starts screwing with things. But again, grist amounts and efficiency have nothing to do with your hops, your hop additions. That's because they're your to wort at that point. And that has to do with time and temperature. So, and volume, that's it. So those are very linear. So Patrick, does that help you in any way? You said the roast malts required adjustment on our pure stout. Did you have to adjust them up or down on the commercial batch?
I would bet that the answer, as always, Jamil, is brew it a couple times, see how it comes out.
True. Yeah. Often you have to make adjustments.
Right.
But what I found from doing the makes sense. We adjusted up, right? So that's what I was saying, was the efficiency was higher on the commercial system. So you adjusted your total grains down. You're working with percentage, which is generally the right thing to do, but you had to adjust that up. When you adjust for efficiency, you've got to maintain the same amount of, once you've multiplied up, you stick with that roast amount, because it doesn't really provide that much sugars. So it doesn't mess with. So yeah, there you go. All right. We should write something up that explains all this.
Nailed it. Lower efficiency on his homebrew kit. Higher efficiency on a pro kit. Yeah.
Right. And so you ended up with less roast in there.
Yeah. It's interesting how it works. You can't, you kind of, maybe you can scale the whole recipe linearly, but you feel like you just need to back off that base malt to get a little bit less sugar. Mm-hmm. And then you might end up heavy on roast if you just do that. If you back the whole thing down, you might end up light on roast.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the guys that know how to scale it, such as Jamil, it's because they've done it a couple hundred times.
Well, and you know, the like I said, the thing I found in doing that Canyon Brew It was everything is scalable and it works. You know, it tends to be, you know, a time and temperature and volume thing. Not necessarily, you know, that commercial equipment is that much better. You can make God's gift to beer. The best beer in the world will be made on a homebrew system, not a commercial system, if you ask me. So there you go. All right. Another good show. Make sure to reach out to our fine sponsors, Josh and RJ at brewchatter.com. Reach out to John Blickman, feedback@blickmanengineering.com. He essentially set that up just to collect comments from the show. Because I kept saying feedback, and he was like, we don't have a feedback at Blickman Engineering email address. So he set it up. I told him to set it up, so he did. So
it took 8 years for him to hear a show.
He appreciates, he gets these, and he actually enjoys them. And he tells me, he's like, yeah, people are very nice and very complimentary. So as you all should be, because the guys, he's actually paying cash for you guys to be able to listen to this for free. So I think that's very sweet of him. That's how much he loves homebrewers and why he deserves our support. And thank you, my friend, Travis, for joining me on this. I had a good time. You were wonderful to travel with, wonderful to brew with, wonderful to go to football games with, and wonderful to do shows with. So until then, everybody, brew strong.
Brew strong.